Thank you, Jonathan. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to what should be a very interesting presentation this morning from Randy Mayer and his co-presenter, Owen Parker. Randy is an epidemiologist and director of the Office of Medical Cannabidiol at the Iowa Department of Public Health. In Randy's capacity at this agency, he has oversight for the implementation of the Medical Cannabidiol Act, which was passed by the Iowa General Assembly in 2017 as House File 524. Randy also serves as the chief of the Bureau of HIV, STD, and Hepatitis, and oversees 20 staff members who administer prevention care and surveillance programs for HIV, hepatitis C, and other sexually transmitted infections. Randy has been recognized nationally by his peers for his work in modernizing HIV criminalization statutes, and locally by community advocates for his dedication in the fight against HIV and viral hepatitis. Randy holds a Master of Public Health in Epidemiology from the University of Minnesota, a Master of Science in Cell Physiology from Purdue University, and a Bachelor of Science in Botany from Iowa State University. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome Randy Mayer.
Thank you. I am not a first-timer here. I've actually been here a couple times for breakfast, but I live in Ames, so I don't get down here at 7 o'clock that early every day. So my husband and I live in Ames, and he's the dean of the graduate college at Iowa State University. So I'm here in this capacity to talk about the Office of Medical Cannabidiol. And I'm going to get it kicked off here, but I'm going to hand it over to Owen, who I've recently hired to be the program manager, because as a good director, the best thing to do, hire staff and get out of their way and let them do their job. So I just want to say, in 2017, Medical Cannabidiol Act was passed, and it was a bit of a surprise to the Department of Public Health. We really weren't involved in sort of the negotiations and behind this, and it was given to the department to regulate. We're really not a regulatory agency, so that was also unusual. But we took on the challenge. We were given no funding to do this and no staffing to do it as well. So that's how it came to me as a bureau chief in HIV, STD, and hepatitis to implement. And really my criteria or qualifications were to be able to write regulations very quickly and do a lot of competitive bids to get the manufacturers in place, the dispensaries in place. The state was given a very short timeline, a year and a half, to have dispensaries open. And so it really has been a challenge. There were a number of us that essentially volunteered to step up without just sort of adding it as other duties as assigned to our jobs. A year and a half now into it, we've been able to finally get those staff positions. And so Owen is the program manager. We have three staff positions, and I'm just finishing the last hire. So things are going well. If you've been paying attention to the news, you saw the dispensaries opened on December 1st, just like they were required to do by the statute. So I'm very pleased with everything that has happened so far. The last thing I'll say is it's a very unusual program compared to other programs in other states. We are certainly not the first state to go down this route. In fact, we're about the 35th or so to have a medical cannabis program. It is a medical cannabis program. It is a marijuana-based program. But it's all under the rubric of cannabidiol. Cannabidiol is CBD, so that is certainly one of the cannabinoids. There are over 200 cannabinoids, and the statute says that you can make any combination of cannabinoids can be put together in our program. THC and CBD are the two that most people are interested in. So I'm going to let Owen talk a little bit more about the program. I'm just telling you it's a little bit unique. It's like saying you can grow any vegetable as long as you call it corn. It's taken sort of nationally, it's taken some of the other industry by surprise in that they sort of overlooked our program and expected it to be a hemp-based program because most CBD programs are hemp-based. But ours is really a cannabis program. And very recently, the national pundits have sort of discovered that, in fact, it is a full program. And so it's been sort of fun working on that aspect of it. So I'm going to turn it over to Owen and let him do the presentation for you.
I'm just going to go over some of the highlights of the act and the program thus far.
Can you stand up at the mic? Just so that
you can do that.
It's still great.
Yeah. So Randy mentioned we didn't get, you know, a ton of funding to do all this. So on top of building the regulatory infrastructure, we're trying to get out and educate as much as we possibly can. So this is our core presentation. We've given this around the state to physician groups, to medical schools, CMEs, as universities, basically any stakeholder, you know, in the healthcare environment that would be interested. So these are just kind of some of the basic things I'll cover. I'll kind of go high level with a lot of it just for the sake of time. But the medical cannabidiol board, the card process, who's a patient, who's a caregiver, the qualifying conditions, some of those healthcare practitioner responsibilities, that's a big one. Just from an educational standpoint, a lot of physicians aren't totally sure how everything works. Manufacturing, dispensing inspections, and then some of the products. So these are kind of what the code provides overall. To possess, use, dispense, deliver, transport, administer cannabidiol. As Randy mentioned, it's kind of elaborating on the previous Cannabidiol Act, which basically just allowed for protections for mothers who had children with those severe seizure disorders. So it allowed kind of some protections for them to possess those products. You mentioned that the legislature kicked the statute to the department to write the rules. We based a lot of this on Minnesota, actually. So about 80% of our rules are from Minnesota's program. It's very similar in terms of form, quantity, number of licenses, and also just state culture in general. So this is kind of what Randy mentioned. It's the only definition like this in the country. So any product can have no more than 3% THC by weight. We still call that cannabidiol, but kind of I'll just introduce it now. One of the interesting things about that is when you go by percentages, it really doesn't restrict the amount of cannabinoids you would put in a product. As I'm sure you probably know, when you buy pharmaceuticals, you buy it in milligrams. So we actually have, in other states, they have caps on milligrams per dose for a given product, usually around 10 milligrams. But for instance, when you go by percent weight, we can have even up to, we have products with 20 milligrams of THC in them, actually. But in general, it must be delivered in a form recommended by the Cannabidiol Board, approved by the Board of Medicine, and put in administrative rule by the Board of Health. So this is our this is our board, and kind of an important thing to discuss is that any aspect of the program that would be elaborated on, whether that's forms, conditions, more licenses, anything like that, has to go through our Cannabidiol Board. One of the big questions is people think that, you know, we have a program and then legalization is going to happen tomorrow. And that just would not be the case whatsoever. A lot of states, they have loose caps on licenses. It's very easy to expand their program, where any expansion to ours would have to go through our Cannabidiol Board, and then these boards of health, and then also the legislature. So really, it would take a lot of discussion for any expansion of the program. But this is kind of what the board does. Big one, accepting and reviewing petitions to add conditions. This is a big one. We've recently added autism, more specific childhood autism that has self-injurious behavior. We've added ulcerative colitis, which fits under one of our other current conditions. And all of those, any member of the public can submit a petition, and then the Cannabidiol Board would deliberate on that. They make recommendations to the legislature on any change in the program. As I mentioned, we just finished up that document. They advise us on the locations of the dispensaries, and the revision of the statute if we wanted to ever change that definition of cannabidiol or change that 3% THC cap. So this is the registration card process. As you can see, they look just like your driver's license. So we're actually a unique state also where you would have to, the department approves an application that comes in, but then there's still accountability on the patient to go and actually get their card made at the DOT. What this kind of allows is instant access for law enforcement to our system. So in the same way, if you got pulled over and you had a product, in the same way they look up your license plate number, they could look up your cannabidiol number, and that would just be a non-starter if those didn't match. So if you didn't have this card with you, it'd be essentially impossible for you to be a patient in the state of Iowa. And at this point, we don't have any reciprocity with any other states. So every patient or caregiver would have to have this with them if they're going to have product with them and be traveling in any capacity. So these are this is the registration card process. We're really proud of this. Previously, it was all paper-based. Now we actually have an online version of our application. So a patient could go to our website here, and then they would download our healthcare practitioner form. That's the first step, to have that discussion with your practitioner about if this would be a therapeutic option for you. Then you'd have to submit a copy of your photo ID. That's proof of state residence. Then proof of reduced fee, if it's applicable. People on disability or Medicaid have the option to have their fee reduced to become a patient. They would submit that to us, through paper-based or in this online form, which is very simple. So again, you'd much like a lot of online forms that you fill out now, you take pictures of those documents, you upload them, it takes you to a pay screen, and then you're done. Versus the paper-based, you know, you have to send it in, snail mail, administrative, you know, overhead to verify everything. We have to send your approval letter back. That can take up to 10 to 14 days, whereas we've had patients submit and approved in the same day, even in a matter of hours, with our new system here. So who is a patient? A patient can be of any age, but they must be a permanent resident of Iowa. You cannot be convicted of a disqualifying felony offense related to any type of substances. Minor patients, we do not give a registry number. That's more just to protect the identity of the minor. And this is kind of what I was saying with that online version of our form. You can see how there's just two steps. You'd fill out the demographic information, much like the paper form, and then there's the attestation that you submit that takes you right to a pay screen, and you're done. We have, you know, not the most tech-savvy patients all the time, even still figure this out. You know, 70, 75-year-olds have no issue filling this out. So these are our qualifying debilitating medical conditions. there's a very wide range in the medical cannabis programs of what conditions are available. So in ours, we have 9, or we have 11 now, I guess it would be, that we've added since the program started. But one of the big ones, as I'll kind of show you, is untreatable pain. This is, you know, you can see from the definition, anybody who's gone, you know, who's had any type of chronic pain, they've gone through multiple modalities, they've tried a lot of different things. This is far and away our most certified condition. It's about 52% of all of our patients now are under this condition. You know, there's a lot of theories, and there's not a lot of, obviously, concrete research on medical cannabis as it stands, just because of the catch-22 with getting funding to do research on a Schedule I drug. So this is more anecdotal, but a lot of this, in terms of information from other states, is due to the opioid epidemic, and a lot of physicians just looking for another tool in the belt. It's not a panacea, but just looking for something else to combat that. These, as I mentioned, anybody can submit a petition to add a new condition to the program. This is on our website also. You just have to submit a narrative, you know, kind of why you feel that this condition should be added, some research, and this is deliberated by our cannabidiol board. They're a board of 9 physicians, so the information must be very compelling for them to even consider it. They've denied, I'd say, 8 out of 10 or so of the conditions that that are proposed. So this is a breakdown by our conditions. As you can see, 51% of them are untreatable pain, and then even some of these other percentages are related to cancer with, you know, some degree of pain. So physicians certify them differently, but a lot of it realistically could fall under some degree of pain. If you add all those percentages together, it's, you know, almost 65%. And then a lot of the remaining ones are some of those excitatory nervous system conditions you hear, you know, seizures, epilepsy. Those make up a lot of the other one, and then some of our other conditions, you know, just kind of, they round out the top, but they're not necessarily highly certified. So who is a caregiver? This is the other option. So you think about a lot of people, you know, that are in long-term care facilities, or they're minors. They don't have the ability to go to a dispensary and purchase product themselves. So they can have someone with, you know, a guardian or durable power of attorney can be certified and linked with that patient, which allows them to go and purchase product on the patient's behalf and then even administer the product for them. This is a problem still in facilities. The statute provides, you know, protections for stakeholders within the state, but that becomes an issue with any facilities that have a lot of federal money flowing through them, just because, again, on the federal level, it's a Schedule I drug still. So you can see this is our adoption of the program over the last year. You can see how early on, you know, there's not a lot of incentive for patients to go and get certified because there's no products to purchase. We got closer to our go live here, the number of applications that we were processing each month started to increase, and now it's definitely J-curved. You can see how, you know, last month we had, or in November we had 200 leading up to the go live, and then just last month we had almost 400 applications that we certified. This is not an uncommon situation. You see, once a program goes live in most states, it takes time, it's a melting ice cube, it takes time for physicians to get on board, it takes time for patients to educate themselves, to feel comfortable having the conversation. But then given time, these numbers just start to spike. For instance, Pennsylvania started with a medical cannabis program and they signed on 80,000 patients last year. Granted, they're a state of 12 million people, but you can just kind of, you can take it to scale, and most programs are following a very similar path. So at this point, you can see that's one of the big things in the news you see. There's no doctors that are certifying. It's not necessarily true. They're just kind of spread out, and they're a little more difficult to find because a patient does have to have a relationship with their provider. And so if their specific provider, especially in the rural areas, isn't willing to have that conversation, the patient is in a lot of ways out of luck. So now we're over 1,000 issued cards, and then also 439 unique physicians who have certified patients. You can see this is the cards issued by county. This is a little bit older of a chart, as you can see. But obviously, the most densely populated areas are the ones that have the most patients. You can see that, for instance, Polk County, that's where one of our dispensaries is. Woodbury, that's another one. Black Hawk and Waterloo is another one. And Scott is where the other dispensaries are. So you can see more of these densely populated areas are where our dispensaries are located. This is the big one, the healthcare responsibilities. This is far and away the most question I get. Is a specific certificate or license needed for physician certified? No. There are states that do require that. Iowa does not. You just have to be an MD or a DO at this point. And it should not include a physician's assistant or ARNPs. Actually, our cannabidiol board is recommending to the legislature to allow mid-level providers just because they can already write scripts for anything. So to just kind of box them out of this, the board kind of felt was not necessary. So adding mid-level providers, the ability to certify is one of their main recommendations. What opportunities do we provide for physicians? Even though we don't require CMEs to certify patients, we do have some. These are Iowa-based ones. So this is Dr. Jolene Smith. She's a Mayo-trained anesthesiologist who had experience in Minnesota's cannabis program. She started practicing in Iowa, and she has a lot of really good granular information for healthcare providers on just cannabinoid therapy in general. This is one that I gave basically the hour version of this presentation to DMU in October. And then these are additional ones. So I mentioned the states like Pennsylvania, New York do require CMEs by their physicians. So these would be opportunities for physicians to take more institutional or, longer rigorous education. But these are about $300. We don't have the funding, again, to reimburse physicians for this, but it's something that they can do if they're interested. Some of the resources we provide, this is a big one too, is, there's only so much good research, again, information for physicians, but there is some good stuff out there. This is a review of the form and dose considerations for physicians. Minnesota made this, kind of a big difference between Minnesota and us. And one of the other recommendations the cannabidiol board made is that when Minnesota's law got written, they had got a large appropriation for research to do with their patient and physician populations. It makes a lot of sense with something that there isn't clear-cut information on is how does your stakeholder population using it. And so this is, again, form dose for a given qualifying condition by Minnesota's patient and physician population. That's a really good one. This is a federal health document that Canada, much more obviously progressive market in regards to this, made for their healthcare practitioners. This is a year one report. Just kind of, they studied all their sent surveys to all their patients and physician population for their program and kind of asked them what they thought about it. So while our programs aren't identical, I would definitely give people an idea of what to expect to some degree. Just like us, their largest condition is pain. So they did a specific study on intractable and treatable pain. And then this is just a repository of all types of articles that any physician or patient would be interested in to get as granular as you would want with it. So this is one of the other things, you know, patients come in and they, you know, they call and they're disappointed their practitioner won't have it. And they're like, how can they do that? But there's just the healthcare practitioners under no obligation to participate. They can just say no. It's just that simple. But if they do, they just need to provide information on the risks, benefits, and side effects and have their own attestations as well. This is the document that practitioners must discuss with their patients. It's very high level, just kind of, you know, what are the cannabinoids, how do they work, contraindications, side effects, information on use, don't drive, just fairly basic information like this. So this is one of the other big ones is physicians all think that their DE license is going to get taken away and that, you know, they're going to have all types of, cases brought against them, but it's just simply not the case. See, there's some very common questions. Do I put my staff at risk? Do I put myself at risk? My DEA registration, malpractice suits. And we kind of did a analysis with our attorney general for our program. Some other licensees have done the same thing. And at this point, medical cannabis has been a thing since 1996. There's well over, there's close to 1 million medical marijuana patients in the nation. There's almost 500,000 providers that are taking part in this, and you cannot find a single case of any malpractice being brought against a physician. The only time that has happened are those physicians that are just flagrantly just writing scripts all day without establishing any type of relationship with the patients that they're certifying. That's kind of the main issue. But these are basically in our code right here. Basically, if you're following the rules of our state, there's nothing to worry about as a practitioner, assuming you're following the rules. So again, the DEA registration, these are even a couple cases that we found. Just basically, again, if you're following the rules of your state and there's nothing to be worried about as a practitioner, there's no documented cases of any malpractice being brought against a physician also. And this is the big thing, is it's because you are certifying that they have the condition. You are not prescribing medication. That's the big protection that's allowed by that. Because when you're prescribing, you're giving dose and form recommendations. You are basically allowing someone direct access to the medication, whereas, again, this is just about certifying the condition. So these are, as I mentioned, these are where our dispensaries are located. So you can see they're kind of like spread across the I-80 corridor right here. Des Moines, Sioux City, Council Bluffs, Waterloo, and Davenport. We have 3 total licensees. So we have 2 groups that have 2 licenses and a single that has just one. So MedPharm Iowa, they're the vertically integrated operator, meaning they manufacture, make products, and then have 2 dispensaries. Their manufacturing facility is here, and then their 2 dispensary locations are Sioux City and Des Moines. Have a Heart is a group out of Washington, who has a dispensary in Council Bluffs and Davenport, and then Iowa Cannabis Company in Waterloo. They are another operator who has experience in Washington. So now we'll kind of go into this. So one of the other big things, you've seen a lot of other markets with the problems with public health, is just there's very low barrier to entry to get a license. For instance, Colorado, Washington, Oregon, basically when those markets got started, if you had $3,000 in a heartbeat, you could get a license. Which some of those people aren't the most responsible, aren't the most experienced with compliance. But one of the ways you can kind of mitigate a lot of those risks, or you create higher barriers to entry, you put a lot more scrutiny on the people that you license, which then allows you, for fewer licenses, you can not only watch them closer, but those licensees are much more likely to be very responsible. They have a lot to lose. So if you set higher licensing fees, you set higher application fees, you just box out a lot of people that, in all reality, wouldn't be great operators anyways. So we licensed Bed Farm Iowa first, and then Iowa Relief just this past summer. And Iowa Relief is another multi-state operator. So all of our licensees have a lot of experience doing this in other markets. If they don't, for instance, Bed Farm doesn't specifically have any experience, but they run a global manufacturing company that extracts molecules from plants to make pet and human products. So this fits right into what they do already as a company. So they're not reinventing the wheel. This is what our dispensaries look like. You know, they're not those dingy, dirty looking, Bob Marley's cousin, that's, selling you stuff. These are more like posh kind of, pharmacy retail type of environments, very comforting. Our licensing fees for these are also very high. Again, you can have more responsible operators. You can watch those operators more closely if you create higher barriers to entry. So how do we monitor compliance? This is a big one. Go. I'm sorry.
Time, I didn't know about that. Get to the products, though, so they can sort of see what's available.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So forms, quantities. Yeah, I was just, used to this being the hour presentation. I get a little start going with it. These are forms and quantities. Big one, no edibles. Nothing can be smoked. We just actually, the board just passed vaporization. That's just the concentrates. But these would be what the products would be like. So we have, there's ratio products of CBD to THC. You have one that's very CBD forward, something that's, kind of something that are in the middle, and then something that's more THC forward. These would be formulated for different conditions that we have. You have, again, one of the other things is these are not people, it's important to realize these are not, infused Cheetos or sodas or joints or anything like that. These are kind of CPG, very well formulated based, nearly pharmaceutical products that go through very similar processes. So they make a tincture, capsules, and then a cream. These are the capsules, so they make all of the same formulations but in different forms. So you can see there maybe some people prefer the tinctures. It's like a sublingual oil, like in a pipette. Some people prefer the capsules. They just take it and it's just your traditional capsule. And then the lotions or creams are more for localized pain or conditions. One of the other big things is in other markets that people run into, you're starting to see this in the space, are recalls just from faulty testing. We've kind of gotten out ahead of this. We've worked with our state hygienic lab and we very rigorously test all of our products. So the oil that comes out when they extract the oil, that gets tested for solvents, metals, microbiological impurities, and pesticides. And then also then when they take that oil and they formulate the products, then they have to test those products again. Because we have to validate the potency, the cannabinoid content. Again, is what it says on the bottle, what you're taking, is the dose consistent? That's one of the things we're really concerned about, is homogeneity of the dose. And then also for microbiological impurities that could have been introduced during the packaging process. And these are kind of the prices. Might seem a little spendy, but there's actually a pharmaceutical CBD out there now, Epidiolex, that was FDA approved for Lennox-Dravet syndrome, one of those early childhood seizure disorders. And that's going to cost, estimated, about $32,000 a year. So when you think about maybe $100 or so a month, it's actually fairly reasonable. The only thing, though, again, kind of what I mentioned, Schedule I, drug, federal dollars, insurers can't really play ball. So all of this is out of pocket for all of our patients. There are no reimbursements whatsoever. And I tried to kind of keep it as high level as possible, but that would be kind of a high level overview of the program as it is thus far.
So you did skip over. Because I asked you to, but the dosing or how much you can get. So you get a 90-day supply at one time of any product or every product. So the medical board has really tried not to put barriers in front of people, knowing that there are only 5 dispensaries, so you can go there and get quite a large supply. We found that dosing is very individualized for your condition, so we also didn't want to say, you're limited to this amount for this condition, because it really depends on the severity of the condition. So right now, it's pretty open with the amount you can get at any one time. If you find that you use it up quicker than you thought you expected to, you can go back and talk to them about changing your dosing and get more and those kinds of things. So we try to be, our board has really worked very hard to make sure that people can get the products that they need when they need them. So we can open it up to questions now, too, if you, anybody wants to ask. Thank you all for hanging in with us for plus 8 o'clock. We didn't mention the seed-to-sale tracking system, but we do. That was part of the bill. We do track everything that happens at the manufacturer, at the dispensary, the inventory. We make sure that there's no loss at any particular time. We really work very hard on that. We built a new seed-to-sale tracking system. So I think we also have the diversion aspect well covered. But I saw some questions, Matt.
As far as, I think you mentioned that you have to go to your regular physician. If your regular physician does not believe in this or does not want to participate, are you allowed to go to another doctor to get a prescription?
So I wrote the rules. So knowing that most people that have these conditions have quite a few physicians, so you have specialists, you have primary care physicians, so any physician who can certify that you have that diagnosis. So if they're comfortable saying, yes, you do have the diagnosis, then they can certify. We understand there are still people who are struggling with that, so we've asked physicians if they would be willing to let us refer people to them if they're willing to certify and know about cannabis. We haven't really gotten a lot of uptake on that, so right now there's not much we can help with that, so you essentially have to just find another physician in your area who knows something about cannabis and be more willing to certify.
We created an opt-in list, like as Randy mentioned, that any provider that wants to be a part of the program or make themselves available can opt into that. We're waiting for a kind of threshold number of physicians we're comfortable with, because obviously they'll get bombarded with calls from patients. We're thinking around 10, but we do have 7 physicians across the state that have opted in to take part.
Yes,
Ben. Is all the cannabis grown here in Iowa, and is it vertical manufactured? If they produce it, are they the same ones that take the oils out and then take it to the lab?
Yeah, so ours is written that we have what we call manufacturer. So the manufacturer is a grower and the extractor and the product developer. So they do all of that. They're also the only ones in the statute who are allowed to transport. So we can't have delivery or anything from dispensaries to patients. So they have to actually deliver the products to the dispensary. We have a take-back program as well. If you try a product, you don't like it, you don't want it in your house, you can take it back to a dispensary. The manufacturer then picks it up and destroys it. So yes, they do all of that. It's all an enclosed facility, no windows, locked, lots of regulation about security, those kinds of things. So we have two manufacturers, and we'll have two growers. It's kind of Matt's here, but he's not a legislator anymore, right? So I can say this. It's sort of a don't ask, don't tell, sort of where the plants originally came from. So they set up their manufacturer facility, and they tell us when it's stocked with plants, and suddenly we come in as the regulator. So we don't know how they got there. We don't want to know. But then from that point on,
it's just an inherent chicken and egg kind of problem.
Yeah, there's no other way to do it. So.
There's no other, yeah, you, it's just they fall from the sky.
We don't know where they came from. We don't know how they got there.
You bring up a good point about, I already had my question, but then your comment made me laugh. It seems like this kind of like highly regulated, don't call it pot kind of thing where Iowa is and I suppose some other states, and then kind of the Wild West where they just legalize it and open it to recreational tourism.
Yeah.
On that spectrum, do you guys see where 10 years from now we might be, or do you see where like the New England Journal of Medicine or something is starting to put their thumb on the scale as to where we might wind up on that?
You want to answer that here? I mean, so Owen worked in the business before.
This is my fourth year in the space, and I mean, you definitely see, I mean, we've seen, you know, almost like 10 states a year now at this point, almost adopting it. And, you know, it really just depends on culture. Kind of the way that I always think about it is kind of like, it's concealed carry. You know how there's some states, you know, like Texas, where you can walk in, you know, to Walmart with an AK-47 on your back. I think of those as like the Colorado, Washington, and Oregons of the cannabis space. And there's places where it's very conservative, where it's very difficult. And that might be your more conservative states where their programs always stay medical. And then I definitely think at some point the laws become federal, will need to intervene. And then it will still be up to states, I think.
I think Iowa will go very slowly.
I would expect federal intervention before Iowa would do anything.
Yeah. I think, you know, what they're going to look at this year is, does that 3% cap make sense, and are they going to hold on to that? I think we have a new manufacturer coming in that's probably got some feelings on that, and we'll sort of be working on legislators to think about adjusting that. The thing that it makes difficult is the vaporizing. So they want to be able to offer a vaporized version because you can avoid the digestive system and the amount of time it takes to get the effects that you're trying to get, and it makes it very difficult to titrate yourself because you're not really sure if it's working yet, if you have waited long enough, that kind of thing. So if you can avoid that with a vaporized form, that would be very helpful. It's easier for someone to know exactly how much they got, whether it's working. So a vaporizer would essentially warm it up and then allow you to inhale it that way. The manufacturer that we have right now says that they don't think they can do that with a 3% THC. So with a high THC product, they don't think they can vaporize it. It also makes it, the 3% makes it difficult for us to know how to measure that. So how would we know that in fact what you're delivering is 3% in a vaporized form, because that's really difficult to measure. Right now it's very easy in a weight to say how much THC is in a product. So I think that they will be looking at that very closely and trying to affect legislators. You know, and I think it's not surprising, legislators aren't ready to do anything yet because we just opened the doors on December 1st. So it's really very early in the program to say, are these products working for people, and is this a good program as it stands?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that was my question. Has there been arrangements made for maintaining data as far as the effectiveness in the program? It seems like there isn't much real hard data.
So that's what Owen was talking about. Yeah. Minnesota's done a good job on their products. They have no cap on their THC, so they have very high THC products in Minnesota. So it's a different program from that point of view. But we don't have the ability, I mean, we know what people are buying, but we don't have the ability to do any research about that. So Minnesota also got an appropriation when theirs was passed to collect that sort of information. So they have very good documentation. What products did people buy? Did the people say it was effective? Did their providers say that they thought it was effective for their patients? Were there side effects to that? And what were those? And so they're collecting a lot of that information, and that's what we put on our website, just so people can sort of see what's happening in Minnesota, because the products are very similar other than the THC cap.
So my question kind of relates to the last two. You said that people can make requests for certain conditions and oftentimes it's denied, but what I can see, that the conditions that are approved are fairly limited. I'm just curious how soon you think you'll expand more conditions like anxiety, depression, cancer that's not necessarily terminal, and so forth.
So I will say that our board is trying to use the 9 original conditions as sort of the benchmark for, okay, we don't really know how those 9 were chosen, but kind of, okay, we have these 9, so do the other conditions sort of fit with those 9 in terms of the amount of data that we have available for whether this would be effective? If there is a lot of research or a lot of information that it might be detrimental, so for example, a number of programs have PTSD, but there's also a lot of information that for some people it could be detrimental to PTSD. And so I think they're very hesitant about some of those sorts of conditions. The one thing I will say for anybody who wants to petition, the thing that seems to be most effective is that you come and talk to the board directly if you have that condition and you say why you think this would work for you, what your condition is like. So the people who have come and personally talked to them have gotten things approved. The ones who do not show up and just send a petition have not had any success. So I think they're very open to hearing stories about your condition, why you think this would work, have you tried anything in the past, did that work, those kinds of things. So that would be my recommendation. Let me get the legislative here.
Yeah, the board certainly requires a lot of research and compelling information because this also has to go through the Board of Medicine. So they have to make a recommendation to their essentially, you know, governing body that this should be done. So the information has to be very good for them to kind of, you know, go out on a limb and recommend the addition of these conditions.
So
So petitions, yes. So this is that's the other thing about the statute. There are a lot of boards involved in this, so it's kind of a complicated process. So petitions go through our medical cannabinoid board, then they go to the Board of Medicine, and the Board of Medicine has to agree. So that's a lot of physicians that have to agree that this is a reasonable thing to do. The form and quantity actually goes from our board to the Board of Medicine to the Board of Health to the legislature. So that's it's a long process, and it's a lot of physicians and others who are looking at all of our regulations. And all the other regulations don't have to go through the Board of Medicine, but they go through the other two boards as well.
Was that about felony thing on it? Kind of felony, you can't get a permit, period, nothing?
That's the way that it is written right now. That's actually been another
related to
substance abuse, but that's been a recommendation by the board also to remove that.
So the board recommended last year and is recommending this year that they get rid of that because they don't think there is any medically. They don't think it's ethical to withhold what you're considering a medication from a patient for any reason. Especially not felony convictions. And so this is the second year they're going to recommend that change. Yes?
Do the dispensaries participate in the pharmacy monitoring program?
They cannot. So the statute is very clear on the confidentiality of the information that we collect and for what purposes we can release that. So, and it's also excludes pharmacists. So the program has excluded pharmacists in any way. So the dispensaries can have pharmacists who are advising them, but they cannot be at the dispensary because it's still Schedule 1 in the state. So the state would have to reschedule it here in order to allow pharmacists to be part of that. So there are two reasons why we can't use that, the prescription drug monitoring program.
They also didn't particularly want to be involved either.
Yeah, well, some of them do. Some of them really don't want to be in this. Some of them do want to be in this space. So, yes, in the back.
Is the lack of reciprocal agreement put a resident from the state of Iowa in possession?
No, actually, it's written in that we can allow that. So we can, so we don't say anything if you're going to another state. And there are a few states now that have reciprocity. So if you take our card to another state, you just have to follow their laws. If they allow reciprocity, if you got certified in our state, that's fine. You can do that. So the statute does allow for reciprocity coming to Iowa as well. So the problem is that our program is so restrictive in the sorts of products and the 3% cap that it's very different than most other states. So I think it's highly unlikely. I mean, you essentially just have to go through our process so that we can certify your condition.
So that extends to possession. Does it also extend to getting a prescription filled? If you're a resident of this state, you go to Minnesota.
Minnesota's law says that you have to be a resident of Minnesota. Okay. If you're a resident of Minnesota and you come to our state, we do allow for reciprocity as long as your product meets our guideline. So you couldn't bring any product that had higher THC. If you did bring something, though, that had 3% THC or lower, so mostly a CBD product from Minnesota, you would be okay as long as you had a registration card from Minnesota that said you're allowed to have that. I think that, you know, we're going to have to go through a situation where the law enforcement has to deal with that and sort of figure out, okay, is this product okay? Is their card okay? And that sort of thing. So I think it'll probably be a little bit confusing at state at first in the state. But
is that will it take the state's conversation to work that out, or will it take federal
intervene at some point?
I'm surprised that nobody's asked about the farm bill. So the farm bill was just passed. And it just updated and includes the ability to grow hemp and to essentially extract CBD from hemp products so that would be legal in all states. What the state has to decide is whether or not we're allowing that CBD to be sold and be legal in the state. So, and they have to accept the terms of the farm bill. And so I think, and actually, interestingly, hemp falls to the Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship, not to us. So they are the ones who are going to have to decide exactly what we're going to do about the farm bill and growing hemp and allowing CBD products. So that will be a conversation that will be happening this time. For all the CBD products that you find over the counter or you can buy online, we've said very clearly those are not legal in the state of Iowa, even if they have low THC. And we've given that message to local law enforcement, but they have chosen to implement that differently. So in some areas, they said, all right, we're not allowing any over-the-counter CBD products. In other states, they said, that's not a priority for us. We're not really going to go do anything about it. So we have kind of a hodgepodge in the state right now about CBD. But I think the Farm Bill is going to change that, you know, that dynamic completely now that they're allowing hemp to be grown in all states and CBD to be extracted from it. So hemp has, by definition, lower than 0.3% THC. Our products have up to 3%, so 10 times that. And then our statute requires growing indoors in an enclosed space with no windows and that kind of stuff, whereas
entirely, the hemp bill would allow entirely different industries. It's entirely different industries.
But we're actually meeting today with iDolls to talk to them a little bit about what they think is going to happen and where things might go this year.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. That's certainly current events. Still a developing story, as it were. And there is, I guess, some exposure in some ways for physicians and for patients as these sort of wrinkles get ironed out. this morning, my partner Scott woke up with a headache. And I thought, oh, me again. I did it again. And now that I've heard this presentation, it occurs to me he's just laying the groundwork for getting for getting certified. We'll see how long this headache lasts and how intense it is. Thank you very much for those presentations. That was really great. A reminder, I have these basketball and ice hockey tickets available. If there's anyone who is interested in those, they are without charge. Our next meeting is going to be February the 1st. Our speaker is going to be Brad Anderson, who is Executive Director of AARP Iowa. In March, it's John Paul Crizan Cardena, and he is the former Executive Director of Iowa 4-H, who was terminated because of his support for trans kids. Apparently, ISU has a lot of control over whether and how that policy is administered, so it should be an interesting presentation. In April is Josh Mandelbaum, and he is a current developer here in Des Moines wanting to do some pretty spectacular things, high-rise glass, high-rise towers, the kind of thing, and it's going to be pretty exciting and interesting to hear from him. In May, it is Senator Zach Walls, newly minted senator, who is also a recipient of scholarship from First Friday Breakfast Club, and he'll be our speaker in May. So we have all of those to look forward to, and I look forward to seeing all of you at our meeting on February the 1st. Thanks for being here.